You're listening live to the 26th episode of the Armaan and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armaan Rana. It's this 22nd of March, 2025, at 5:01 p.m. We are broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamenam-speaking Musqueam people. Akil is out today, but I do have someone with me in the studio who is going to help me break down what is going on in this, as Melanie Joly, our foreign minister, described, continuing psychodrama that has been taking place in politics since the return of MAGA. George Radna is with me in studio. He is the former director at Be the Change Earth Alliance, a non-for-profit that empowers high school students across British Columbia through action-oriented environmental and climate justice education. Beyond that, he is an organizer who has been involved in a number of campaigns and social movements around democracy and climate change. Most recently, he was the Nevada Deputy Organizing Director for Ballot Cure, that's a mouthful, for the Democrats in the recent U.S. election, playing a key role in ensuring Democrats at least hold on to that critical Senate seat there. George also happens to be a friend of mine from UBC, where he specialized in economics and honors mathematics. Welcome to the show, George.
Thanks so much, Armaan. It's great to be here.
So how's your day going?
Oh, it's going well. Yeah. How about you?
Yeah, it's been all right. Yeah, I'm glad you could join us to replace Akil, who is absconding today. So to get started, we're going to break down politics a bit later. But for our listeners, could you give us a bit more about your journey? You know, how does an econ bro end up as a social justice organizer?
Well, I wouldn't exactly call myself an econ bro, but it's a good question. So a little bit about me. I was born in Washington, D.C. Both my parents are American, and I moved to Canada when I was about 9, and now I'm a dual citizen. And I came to Vancouver to study at the University of British Columbia in economics and math. And ever since I was a kid, I would say I've been oriented towards world issues, concerns of environmental and social injustice. And it's just been deeply part of my identity to work on those issues. And climate change became kind of an issue that really touched me and concerned me when I was around 11 or 12 and has been a through line of my life and my activism. And I went to UBC to try to gain some more quantitative skills to be able to better address social issues, and have found myself working in the nonprofit sector and in social movements and election campaigns since then.
Yeah, awesome. And, I mentioned that you were participated in ballot curing. What does that entail exactly? It literally sounds like you are, fixing the ballots, as Trump always says the Democrats are doing. And, you cross out Trump's name and put Kamala. That's the curing that you're doing? Or what does ballot curing actually entail, and why is that important?
Well, yeah, it's definitely the type of thing that you'd expect Trump to hate, as someone who's concerned about, election fraud. But really, what ballot cure is all about is protecting voters' rights to have their ballots counted. So across the U.S., a really significant trend in voting since the pandemic has been voting by mail. So if you think about voting by mail, one of the challenges is that it's not necessarily that easy to prove your identity, prove you are who you say you are, because you're not going in person to a polling location and showing your ID. Or at least there's a concern that maybe voters would commit fraud by taking a ballot and then submitting it even if it wasn't theirs. And that concern leads to many mail-in ballots being rejected across the U.S. And in Nevada, where I was working, based in Las Vegas, about half of voters in recent elections have been voting by mail. So this is a really significant percentage of the electorate choosing to vote by mail.
What percentage did you say?
It changes each election. I believe it was about 55%.
Oh my gosh, that's a lot.
In the last election, although that number could be, I'm not exactly sure of that number, but in the last, since the pandemic.
The majority of.
Since the pandemic, it's represented roughly a majority. And the trends are that more Democrats vote by mail than Republicans, although the numbers are still big for both parties. Essentially, what I was doing is helping voters who had their ballots rejected because there was a signature issue with their ballot. So if you imagine when you're normally voting in person, you can show your ID. When you vote by mail, the way you prove your ID is by signing the ballot or signing the envelope, to be specific. If you forget to sign the envelope, or if your signature is a bit sloppy or just doesn't quite match what they have on file, your ballot could be rejected. And what you need to do is cure it. That's where the word cure comes in. Yeah. You're curing your rejected, your ill ballot by proving your identity. And there's a number of ways to do that on via phone call, on your mobile phone, going in person, sending in something in the mail. So I was helping voters cure their ballots if they had been rejected.
So what does the day-to-day of that look like for somebody in your job description?
Well, working on a political campaign is the day-to-day, it can be hectic. There's a lot going on. Things move at a really fast pace. But the core of my role was honestly pretty simple. The list of voters who had voted and had their ballots rejected was public. So anyone could look up the record and see a voter that basically tried to vote but couldn't vote or couldn't have their ballot counted because of this technical signature issue. And what we did is we contacted those voters. We reached them by phone calls. We went to their doors and we basically walked them through the steps of how to cure their ballots. And this was a volunteer driven initiative. So myself and my staff, we recruited some volunteers, trained them up and had them make these phone calls and knock on people's doors. And there are many other groups doing this too, but we were one of the bigger groups as we were the presidential campaign. And so, yeah, my day-to-day involved a lot of just kind of troubleshooting that and organizing that program. And we had really great success. This was this election cycle had 23,000 ballots cured, yeah. Across all parties, and we
in Nevada,
yep. And we have not exactly sure the precise number that we helped cure, but it definitely was in the thousands, most likely above 10,000. So we feel like we had an impact in the election.
Yeah, fantastic. And as you mentioned, there was a Senate race there. What was the name of the candidate?
The candidate was Jackie Rosen for the Democrats running for re-election. And she was able to hold on to her seat even amidst a kind of red tide across the country. Yeah. And several Congress people in Nevada were also able to hold on to their seats.
Yeah, awesome. So let's pivot a bit. We're going to break down some clips now that everybody knows who George is and why he's here. We're going to start, of course, with the United States. There are millions of things, going on, in the Trump administration. But to start off, I wanted to draw attention to one thing. And that's, a comment made by U.S. Secretary of Commerce and billionaire Howard Lutnick describing Musk's approach to identifying fraud in Social Security. So let's take a listen to that. Okay.
Let's say Social Security, if you're, I describe it to people this way. Let's say Social Security didn't send out their checks this month. My mother-in-law, who's 94, she wouldn't call and complain. She just wouldn't. She'd think something got messed up, and she'll get it next month.
Yeah.
A fraudster always makes the loudest noise, screaming, yelling, and complaining.
Mm.
And if all the guys who did PayPal, like Elon knows this by heart, right? Anybody who's been in the payment system and the process system knows the easiest way to find the fraudster is to stop payments and listen.
Yeah.
Because whoever screams is the one stealing.
Yeah.
Because my mother-in-law's not calling. I mean, come on, your mother, 80-year-olds, 90-year-olds, they trust the government. They trust, okay, maybe got screwed up. Big deal. They're not going to call and scream at someone. But someone who's stealing always does.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is U.S. Secretary of Commerce describing the Elon Musk head of Doge's approach to identifying fraud in Social Security. What's your reaction to that?
Oh man, there's so many kind of screaming issues with that.
You must be committing fraud.
Yeah, exactly. I know. It makes me want to scream. It makes me want to call Howard Lutnick a bit of a fraudster in this approach. And I mean, I tend to find it difficult to get into the headspace of billionaires just because they live in such a their own little world, and their egos are so big and they just have so much money it's unimaginable. But I'm not sure Elon Musk or Howard Lutnick, even though he has a 90-year-old grandmother, really understands what Social Security checks mean to millions of Americans. I mean, this is a big program. I think there's something like 60, 65, 70 million people who receive monthly Social Security benefits. And I believe many of them would notice and also be impacted by checks disappearing or not showing up in time. So the idea that we would do that, we would cut off people's vital benefit that is keeping people in their homes, paying rent, potentially paying their mortgages, getting food on the table. The idea that we would just cut off those payments in order to test who yells the loudest about it. I mean, there's so many issues with that. There's really so many issues with that.
Yeah, it's what's strange is it's huge, like gaslighting. Like if you complain, then you're a fraudster, so you can't even get it fixed.
Well, it's you if you yell loudly. Now, the grandmothers apparently wouldn't yell loudly. That seemed to be the implication.
I don't know how many grandmothers he's met. It's just like grandmothers are totally cool with just governments cutting their Social Security checks. Apparently, like they'll just be like, yeah, it's whatever. You know, I don't know. Is your grandmother the person to yell?
Both of my grandmothers, who are passed away, you know, they received. They would have complained politely, to their credit, but they would have noticed and complained. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
My mother's U.S. citizen. She recently got on Social Security. I think she would be complaining if these checks cut up. But it's the point is that
all frauds.
Right. Yeah. The point is everyone in my family, they must be frauds.
Yeah. Same with my family. We're all frauds. If you complain. And how would you get it fixed in that? It's kind of like the witch, you know, when you drop a witch into water, and then if she floats, she's a witch. And if she drowns, she's innocent. It's very similar philosophy with you cut off their Social Security payments. So if they just disappear because they, you know, can't exist because without Social Security, then they're probably innocent. And if they complain, then they're a fraudster.
It's a bit mind blowing that this type of kind of fairy tale logic is being applied to a vital benefit. But I think actually, Armand, there is something potentially a little bit more nefarious going on here, because one thing he mentioned in that clip is that people think government works, and they will assume, oh, there must have been some mistake. I'll get my check next time. I actually think part of the strategy of DOGE is to make government work. No, stop working, work less well, which I think in their minds will build rage against the government and justify how they're slashing the government. I feel like it's a bit of a vicious cycle that they want to happen. They want people to think, oh man, Social Security, what a terrible program. This government must be full of waste, must be completely run by
incompetent people. Let's lay them all off.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the nefarious thing about this. It's not all just kind of, you know, yeah, fun and games.
Yeah, for sure. And I think just the broader, you know, this is one example, but the broader cuts we're seeing, you know, Department of Education, I know that he's not able to remove it without Congress, but, you know, they're still laying off huge numbers of people, right? It's kind of a brutal assault in the U.S. administrative state.
Donald Trump is taking a wrecking ball to the U.S. government, and that it is. I just, you know, want people to think about how it's much easier to destroy a building than, you know, build it again. If you take a wrecking ball, you know, you don't have to be that precise. You can just kind of release it and let it break what it breaks. That's kind of what's happening. It's very haphazard. They're, you know, laying people off without or suspending them without pay, and then some of them are coming back, and it's a complete mess. It is not kind of a meticulous taking apart of, say, your building. It's a wrecking ball. But the problem is once it's a building's in rubble, it takes a while to build it again. And that's my big concern long term.
Yeah. Speaking of a wrecking ball approach, let's switch to immigration. So this is a story of a Vancouver woman. She was actually an actress in American Pie. She's an entrepreneur, and she was detained by ICE Let's take a listen to that. Okay, we're having some audio issue. Just let's see. Okay, I will.
We are hitting the market at the perfect time, making holy water the optimal addition to your drink menu.
BC entrepreneur Jasmine Mooney was detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, on March 3rd after crossing the border from Mexico into San Diego. The 35-year-old described the ordeal in a phone interview with ABC Action News.
I was reapplying for my work visa, and with no warning about what was about to happen, I was taken by ICE. They told me I was unprofessional because I didn't have a proper letterhead on my paperwork.
I climb into my warm bed every evening feeling guilty because I know that my daughter's in a concrete cell without even a blanket.
Alexis Eagles says her daughter was held at the border for 3 nights, transferred to a San Diego detention center for another 3, and is now in Arizona.
I was put in a cell, and I had to sleep on a mat with no blanket, no pillow, with an aluminum foil wrapped over my body like a dead body for 2.5 days. We were up for 24 hours, wrapped in chains. There are girls, women that have been in here for weeks, for months, and have not been told anything.
Mooney had been working on her drink business in L.A. last summer with a 3-year work visa, which was unexpectedly revoked in November when she was trying to travel to California from Vancouver. She says she was trying to reapply when she was detained.
There needs to be more clear guidelines and rules, and because Jasmine was trying to follow them. She wasn't trying to sneak into the country and work. She was trying to go about it the right way.
It's shocking that the government resources would be used against a Canadian who has no past criminal history, no immigration violations. It's almost like they're throwing the book at her just to make an example.
Global Affairs Canada oversees the country's diplomatic and consular relations. It has confirmed a Canadian is detained in Arizona, but says it cannot intervene in U.S. entry and exit requirements. Eagles has been told by her daughter's lawyer that she might be released in 10 days, but says the damage has already been done.
What I am livid about is the length of time she's been in custody and the inhumane living conditions these women have been in.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security says detention centers are at capacity, with ICE making over 32,000 arrests since President Trump took office.
So yeah, that is a Global News report on an example of a Vancouver woman who was, you know, in an actress in an American teen movie flick being detained for up to 2 weeks. What was your reaction to that clip? Were you aware of the story?
I think I'd heard the headline, but I hadn't read into it. So yeah. That clip was kind of the first time I'm digesting it. And it's really upsetting. It's really disturbing. I think one of the things the clip highlights, and I think this is an important note, is the sense that there just isn't due process for these arrests and detentions. The sense that people don't know what's happening, why it's happening. It's unclear what the timeline is going to be. It's unclear what the next steps are. It's unclear what they did wrong. And amidst all this uncertainty, they're held in pretty awful conditions. And it reminds me of the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil. I mean, a very different situation. Yeah. That was a Palestinian a permanent resident in the U.S., but just kind of this sense that ICE can come to get you at any time, and you won't know what the story is. You'll be sleeping on the floor with no blanket. It really is disturbing.
Yeah, and this is happening, you know, on a much larger scale to you know, non-Canadians, to Mexicans and other people from South America and Central America, you know, being treated in this way, right? And then now it's, you know, potentially hitting very close to home when somebody from Vancouver is now being treated this way. But you can just see, I know from your vantage point, do you think it's intentional that now people from Canada be targeted this way due to the recent trade tensions between the two countries? Or do you just think it's pure chaos?
I mean, if America, Trump has shown that, you know, under America First policy, there just everyone else who is an American means nothing to him. He does no care for friends, for allies. Canada and the U.S. have had long, long positive relations. And I think with Trump's statements since he's been elected that Canada isn't a real country, these lies about fentanyl crossing the border, these talks about annexing Canada, making it the 51st U.S. state, which is just a crazy idea. I mean, I don't know what motivated this specific arrest, but it certainly fits within a broader theme of Trump viewing his friends as his enemies, and also a broader theme of ICE increasingly detaining people and treating people in these inhumane ways and not providing due process, which I think is just it's really concerning.
Yeah, totally. So we were talking, a week ago about, you know, the Schumer approach to the shutdown. So I'm going to play a clip, but maybe do you want to set things up, a bit more about what were the stakes of this Schumer shutdown fiasco?
Absolutely. So the U.S. is one of the only rich democracies that I know of that has to vote every year, at least, to keep the government open. In many countries, and Canada, and most European democracies, the government just stays open. It doesn't close unless you vote to keep it open. But in the U.S., you have to do that. And because of the quirks of this U.S. democracy, that vote can be difficult. It's not always just an automatic vote. In this case, the Republicans in the Senate needed at least seven or so Democrats to vote with them if they wanted to approve their bill, which basically kept the government open. And their bill was very partisan. It was very, it didn't have any Democratic input. It had a lot of cuts. It had a lot of extra money for the Trump administration to use at its discretion. We'll hear more probably in the clip, but Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Democratic Party, chose to bring along a small group of Democrats to vote for this Republican bill rather than not give it the votes it needed. And this was after Democrats in the House, all but one Democrat in the House of Representatives, did not vote for this bill.
Yeah, sounds good. Let me play that. So this is Nancy Pelosi reacting to Chuck Schumer's decision not to block the bill.
Chuck Schumer's handling of the government shutdown fight. Yesterday on The View, Schumer defended his decision to vote with Republicans on a continuing resolution to avert a shutdown.
I knew it was a difficult choice, and I knew that I'd get a lot of criticism for my choice. But I felt as a leader I had to do it. Here's why. The CR bill was bad, no question. And it allowed a slush fund, which allowed money to be pushed around. And they could cut off anything they want simply by saying it's not essential. So, day two, SNAP, food for poor kids, not essential. Day four, mass transit, New York City subway and subways all over, not essential. Day seven, Medicaid, not essential. People don't need Medicaid, they should get their own health care. And this would happen over and over and over again. And there's no check.
Now Pelosi says she thinks Schumer gave in to Republicans too easily.
I myself don't give away anything for nothing. And I think that's what happened the other day. We could have, in my view, perhaps gotten them to agree to a third way, which was a bipartisan CR for four weeks in which we could have had bipartisan legislation to go forward. They may not have agreed to it, but at least the public would have seen they're not agreeing to it.
Let's bring in Capitol Hill
So yeah, we will not bring in Capitol Hill correspondent. We'll bring in George instead. Why do you think Pelosi, I've never seen that before, Pelosi fighting with Schumer. What is your impression of that? What does that mean?
Well, I think it shows that there is a significant rift within the Democratic Party on how to respond to Trump and the moment. And just to kind of make clear for your listeners what Pelosi was talking about there, the idea that she points out is that if you are going to accept the Republicans' wish to keep the government open, at least do some negotiating, at least try to extract some kind of concessions. And what the Democrats under Pelosi and Schumer did in Trump's first term, I believe it was in his first year in 2017, around a government shutdown, is they negotiated to pass a 2 or 4 week kind of short-term continuing resolution to keep the government open, which gave them time to then negotiate. And they ended up actually allowing the government to shut down to try to rein in Trump's agenda. And I think that in Trump term one was an example of the Democrats kind of using their strategic leverage to try to stop the administration from getting all of its goals. And I think the playbook there was not used this time. Schumer basically just caved, gave Republicans everything they wanted, rather than letting the government shut down, which could have improved his political leverage, or negotiating some kind of temporary deal. And I think the rift between the party is really emblematic of kind of this wider break between the Democrats and how to respond to Trump.
Do you think Schumer is on his way out as minority leader? Who would you want to replace him?
I'm not sure who I'd want to replace him. I mean, Senator Chris Murphy has been a really vocal, a really strong voice on the Democrats showing up to fight and resisting. But I think in this case, I think Schumer is at risk of being voted out. His own caucus, the Senate, can hold a vote to remove him as leader. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, but it seems very possible. And I would like to see the Democrats, you know, it's not about ideology here necessarily. It's not about whether you want progressive policy or moderate policy or whatever. In this moment, I think Democratic lawmakers need to be looking at saving the U.S. democracy, preventing the rise of fascism, and kind of holding on to core government functions. And that should bring the party together. We shouldn't need all this infighting to do that.
Yeah, it makes sense. So you're listening to the Armaan and Akhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are speaking to organizer extraordinaire George Radner to break down the latest in U.S. and Canadian politics. After the break, we'll be looking at the race for PM in Canada. But before that, as mentioned, a quick ad break.
Tune in to Canada Post Rock with your host, P-Bone, where he plays the best in post rock, experimental, electronic, noise, and anything he can put the word post in front of. Fridays, 7:30 to 9 p.m., only on CITR 101.9 FM. I mean, if you had a radio show, P-Bone would probably listen to your show, so...
Did you know that community radio stations in Canada broadcast in more than 65 different languages? This is where stories come alive and where we come together. But as big international media dominates the spotlight, local news and local voices struggle to be heard. Our government must help these local stations continue to do what they do best, serve the unique needs of our communities. We're asking you to go support the Community Radio Initiative at mycri.ca. Stand with us for community radio future.
Young Agrarians is the largest educational resource network for new and young ecological farmers in Canada, with a long-term goal to stop farm loss and ensure future generations can farm. YA offers farmer-to-farmer programming to grow the next generation of food growers by creating access to community, education, on-farm training, land, business mentorship, and other resources. Join our network by checking out youngagrarians.org. That's YOUNGAGRARIANS. .org. Together, let's grow the next generation of viable and ecological farmers on Turtle Island.
Yeah, check it out. I found that canned ham and I put it in a pot of boiling water, and guess what I'm calling it?
Soup?
Hot ham water.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, nourishing radio.
Mm. So watery, and yet there's a smack of ham to it.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Armaan and Akhil Show.
we were speaking to George Radner, and now we're going to be breaking down the upcoming Canadian election. We expect an election to be called tomorrow, and it will be voting on April the 20th, is that's what the leaks are telling us. And, you know, the newly sworn in Prime Minister Mark Carney, according to most recent polls, has, you know, is projected right now to have an, you know, a narrow majority of the seats, 178 seats for him, 131 for the Conservatives, 25 for the Bloc, 7 for the NDP, and 2 for the Green. This is according to the latest 338 Canada projections. The name 338 is no longer super accurate because we now have 343 seats. But this is a great website to get an idea of, you know, where the race is. You know, you still do see some polls which have the Conservatives ahead, but this is the overall aggregate of the polls. And yeah, I wanted to kind of hone in on Pierre Poilievre's strategy with you, George, because, you know, we've discussed it more in the past, you know, how he's approaching things, how he's pivoting. So I want to start off by playing two clips of Pierre Poilievre. We're starting with, this is the most recent clip on Pierre Poilievre's YouTube page. And let's give a listen to that. And the title is Cap Immigration Levels.
Earlier this week, Mark Carney added Mark Wiseman to his list of advisors on Canada-U.S. relations. Mm-hmm. Mark Wiseman was the co-founder of the Century Initiative, a lobby group that wants to bring Canada's population to 100 million people by 2100. Can I get your reaction to that? And what do you think, how do you feel about the idea of rapidly expanding Canada's population to reach 100 million by the end of the century?
Well, it shows that the Liberals would be no different in a fourth term than they were in the first three. The Liberals destroyed our immigration system in their first three terms in power. They followed a radical globalist ideology of massive, uncontrolled population growth that put strain on our housing market, our health care, and our job market. Now, corporate elites like Mr. Wiseman and Mr. Carney loved it because it drives wages down. It takes jobs away from our workers. In numbers that they can't, we can't replace by growth in the job market. But it's terrible for our working class. By bringing on Mr. Wiseman, it shows that Mark Carney supports the Liberal Century Initiative to nearly triple our population to 100 million people. We voted against the Century Initiative in the House of Commons, and the Liberals voted for the Century Initiative unanimously. That is the radical liberal agenda on immigration. We will get back to moderate, reasonable levels of immigration. Our country was built by common sense immigration, but we need to ensure we grow the housing supply, our health care, and our jobs faster than we grow our population. And so I will reject the Century Initiative and get back to common sense immigration that brings people to Canada in numbers that we can hire, that we can house, and that we can care for. That was the best immigration system in the world, and we're going to bring it home again.
So that's clip number one. And clip number two is from a year ago. This was a time when Trudeau was deporting Indian students who had come to Canada and, you know, been enrolled in kind of diploma mills where they're not getting a proper education. And the colleges were shut down. And this was Poilievre's response to that.
Full paychecks and raise their families in peace. So shame on Justin Trudeau.
Let me just restart that clip.
Listen, we have a worker shortage in Canada. We have a demographic problem. Our population is too old. We need 700 young people. We need 700 young people to work in our factories, in our hospitals, in our shopping centers, driving truck, being accountants, lawyers, doctors. We need these workers in our country. It makes no sense for Canada to send them back when they could stay here and earn powerful paychecks and raise their families in peace. So shame on Justin Trudeau for trying to deport these wonderful students. Stop the deportations. Keep the students here. Allow them to apply just like everyone else for permanent residency. The Conservatives will continue to fight.
So, yeah. So what do you make of Pierre Poilievre's recent pivot on immigration? And yeah, what is your overall impression of beyond this immigration? What is the strategy he's been taking and he needs to take going forward?
Wow, yeah, I mean those clips were aptly chosen to kind of highlight a bit of self-contradiction. I mean, Poilievre's whole shtick has been to critique Trudeau and to critique the Liberals. And I think he's identified himself as kind of anti-Trudeau as part of his most kind of fundamental selling point to people, is that he's gonna kick out Trudeau and the Liberals. And now I think, compared with a year ago or even a few months ago, the story is very different. You don't have Justin Trudeau as the prime minister anymore, and you have this huge threat of Trump and tariffs and annexation that has kind of flipped the switch on Canadian politics a little bit. I think in these clips, he's showing kind of a lack of coherence on how he wants to treat immigrants in this country. And I think he's being
very... One of those clips could have been like a immigration activist. Being like, oh, stop absolutely. The deportations, grant them a permanent residency. Shame on Trudeau for deporting them.
Absolutely. So he was being opportunistic in that moment to try to, you know, attack Trudeau, and fast forward a little while, he's maybe taking some inspiration from Trump and how successful immigration restrictions played in the U.S. election to try to sell to the Canadian public something different, which is restricting immigration. It's a little bit incoherent. It's a little bit hard to know exactly what he really believes is the issue, but he's a skilled politician specifically because he will jump on political moments and kind of, that's definitely how he's risen as the challenger.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one thing I noticed when I was canvassing here for the provincial election was immigration was really a very hot button issue. It's political dynamite. Even people who were intending to vote for the provincial NDP here, they were very unhappy about immigration for whatever reason. And yeah, I think the other challenge I think Mr. Poilievre has right now is that I don't know if you noticed, there's this whole other drama going on with the Patrick Bet David podcast in the United States. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. So what happened is that he was supposed to go on the show. Patrick Bet David is basically like a lesser Joe Rogan show. Like, it has maybe 1/50th the viewership. It's still pretty big. It's bigger than a lot of other podcasts, bigger than this podcast or radio show. And he was supposed to, do that circuit of, populist right wing. You know, there's a whole bunch of podcast bros beyond Joe Rogan that helped Trump win in the U.S. election. And Pierre Poilievre was supposed to go on there. And he refused in the end to go on them after all this, the Carney shuffle and him falling behind in the polls, the anti-Trump wave in Canada after Trump is threatening to annex Canada. He declined to go on that podcast. And Patrick Bet David called him out, called him weak. And in doing so, he got some People's Party of Canada, Maxime Bernier's outfit, to tell him to have Maxime Bernier on. So now Maxime Bernier is doing the podcast bros in the United States. And he's been attacking Pierre Poilievre for being weak on immigration. And so the only issue that unites the people who are defecting to the right in Pierre Poilievre to the People's Party, and he could get some mainstream voters on, is immigration. Like people who are shifting to Mark Carney now, what I'm predicting is that's going to be, at least for the next little while at least, he's going to try and push that as this election's about, immigration. But yeah, that's the, it's very fascinating to see. Pierre Poilievre is actually kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, in that he, if he goes too mainstream, you know, he's bleeding votes on the right to Maxime Bernier. But if he is shown in any way to be favorable to Trump, he's losing mainstream Canadians. So that's kind of the balance he's going to dance. And yeah, we'll see if what I predict bears fruit. But any other angles do you think that Pierre Poilievre needs to take now to stay in the game? Or what would you do if you were him?
What would I do if I were Pierre Poilievre? Well, I mean, I like the Pierre Poilievre that was criticizing Trudeau's immigration deportations. I like that sound more than the Pierre Poilievre we just heard, who thinks we should restrict immigration. I think immigration, as a focal point in our politics, we often think about it in a way that I think kind of misses a couple key points. One is that anytime you have significant amount of not just immigration, but migration. Anytime you have a significant amount of people moving, even within your country or within your province, there are going to need to be changes and adaptations. You might need to be building a lot more housing. You might need to be expanding schools and transit and public infrastructure. And I think what often gets missed in this immigration debate, including for mainstream voters who are concerned about immigration, yeah, is that these immigrants are going to come and we're going to get less. There's going to be less services for us. The wages are going to be lower. But really, if we think about it as, well, if we can actually bring in immigrants, regularize people, because I mean that the amount of undocumented migrant labor in this country is also just shocking, and that hurts. That actually does hurt Canadian citizens, because it creates this kind of economy, kind of secondary economy, where people don't have the same rights as citizens and permanent residents. If we can just view immigration more from a lens of what do we need to do to adapt, immigration can be extremely beneficial. It can benefit everyone. It can make the economy more resilient. It could bring us closer together, I think. So that's kind of my view on the immigration politics and how they're often, I think sometimes they're taken in very kind of othering ways and kind of very culture war ways, but I don't think that's what I think we should be really focused on. Good policy to adapt to changing migration patterns.
Yeah,
and welcome more immigrants.
Yeah, totally. Like if you look at British Columbia, for example, a key component to why our housing prices are so high is people in the rest of the country, they work in the rest of the country, they live in the rest of the country, and then they buy property in British Columbia to retire. Wealthy people, that's what they do, right? And those people, they drive up, property costs. They drive up healthcare costs, right? And it's, it's a good thing because we live in a very beautiful place in British Columbia, but we kind of have to be aware of the fact that we're one of the few places in Canada where it's, very nice to retire. There's good weather in the winter. It's not super freezing. So a lot of people want to retire here. And we need to kind of plan for that in the way you're describing. In a similar way, you would have to plan for immigrants in a way that potentially Trudeau failed to do. And that kind of led to some of this, backlash against immigration. So I don't have clips for the rest of our friends, but what is your impression been of Mark Carney so far? Has he taken over? What do you account for his wave in the polls? Do you think it'll persist? And what do you think he needs to do?
Yeah, his rise has been quite interesting to watch. And to me, the most fascinating element has been how quickly the Canadian public was willing to kind of return to the Liberals, who they were quite dissatisfied with for several years, with a new face. And I think people are viewing this moment as one of significant instability and of significant turmoil with Trump's threats of tariffs and possible annexation. And I think Mark Carney seemed like a really safe bet. I mean, I think that's what it came down to. He's got a background in finance and economics. He's pretty centrist. He seems like he's got his head screwed on straight. He seems competent. When you hear him speak, it seems like he knows what he's talking about. And he, I guess, just has enough charisma. I wouldn't say he's a super charismatic politician, but maybe that's what Canadians are looking for in this moment. Maybe they're looking for stability and kind of relatively straightforward policymaking that isn't Justin Trudeau. And I think he's benefiting a lot from not being named Justin Trudeau, because it's clear that Trudeau was a big source of the unpopularity of the Liberals.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you go back to Pierre Poilievre, I think Pierre Poilievre, as you mentioned earlier, he made a fundamental error where he made the source of all the problems in Canada Justin Trudeau, which kind of allowed this sort of thing to happen, right? Where you, if it was just the carbon tax and Justin Trudeau was the cause for all the economic challenges we were facing, if you get rid of the carbon tax, you replace Justin Trudeau with somebody else, then that kind of satisfies the requirements of his argument. And I think the other issue is that he, which is like a fatal mistake, I think, for a conservative politician in Canada, he went hard against the federal NDP. To win nationally, you need a decently strong federal NDP, right? That is like, if you are the Conservative Party in Canada and you're attacking Jagmeet Singh, and he was attacking in a very personal way, they almost got into a fight in Parliament. This is not what you want to be doing. You're cutting ads against Jagmeet Singh. You are, you know, having your people attack him on social media, call him a sellout, all these things. If you're driving up Jagmeet Singh's negatives, that means when the Trudeau gets replaced by a new shiny object, you're making it easier for NDP voters to shift to Mark Carney. So I think that was done out of hubris and frustration with the fact that the government wasn't collapsing when the Conservatives were way ahead for years. Pierre Poilievre said, okay, let me go and point my bazooka at Jagmeet Singh to bring about the collapse of this government. But I think the unforeseen consequence of that is he's made Jagmeet Singh look very weak to a lot of NDP supporters, which means that they are a lot of NDP supporters. Some of them would vote Conservative, but a lot of them, the ones who were left, are probably more open to voting Liberal than Conservative, maybe a lot of social issues. So, yeah, I think that was I think a part to what we were seeing here. What do you think the NDP you know, needs to be doing? You know, if you were campaign manager of the NDP, what would you be advising Jagmeet Singh? Right now, he's talking about, you know, running for prime minister still, but, you know, he's at 10 points in the polls. What actually should he be doing?
Well, I think there's a lot the NDP can be doing, and I think what we need right now is just a broader discourse on what some of the solutions are to the present moment and the issues we are facing. So part of the rise of Pierre Poilievre, which I would say I've been following over the last few years, is how he's been so successful in tapping into concerns, bread and butter concerns of everyday Canadians. A lot of his messaging has been focused on the price of groceries, how expensive heating our homes are, why it seems hard to get ahead, why this isn't what Canada used to feel like. And he was successful at pinning all that, as you mentioned, on Trudeau, and he kind of honed in on the carbon tax as sort of this symbolic policy for the entire Trudeau agenda, which was why we were experiencing inflation and kind of a slower economy than many people would want. And I think he's struggling to change the kind of point of attack. But I think this creates space for the NDP, because Poilievre's solutions to inflation and to the housing crisis and to cost of living, they were not real solutions. They were not good ones. We know that he has a record of voting against building new housing, against expanding public programs that help with affordability and the cost of groceries. So he's not the leader we need, in my opinion, to face the challenges of kind of this post-pandemic inflationary world. And I think the NDP, even if there isn't a clear chance to, say, gain power this election, there's a lot of space to be talking about the types of real solutions that could help people and also address bigger concerns like climate change, like our healthcare systems across many provinces crumbling. And those solutions involve, in my opinion, raising the taxes and broadening the social safety net and really building out government programs, building out the public good.
Yeah. It's a tricky situation. Like the NDP, unlike the Bloc, they contest almost every riding in Canada, right? So the Bloc is able to kind of you know, focus, they're a small party, but focus their resources on a number of seats. But the NDP is competing in almost every riding. And even if the ridings in which they're strong, they're geographically, you know, across the country. You know, there's something in Toronto, there's something in Vancouver, there's something on the island. So you have to really travel around. So even if Jagmeet Singh, which he's probably doing, you know, similar to the Ontario election where they're going on, you know, purely a defensive game of holding on to what they currently have, it's going to be very tough just because things are so, you know, far apart. The issues are a lot different in a unit town in Ontario compared to, you know, let's say somewhere on the island. We'll see what you know, what he does. We're almost at the, you know, end of today's show, but there was one other topic I wanted to bring up, and I'm not sure you know, how familiar you are with the story, is the BC NDP has introduced something called Bill 7. Have you heard of this? I can give you a quick rundown.
Yeah, remind me.
So basically, it's a bill that grants the government emergency powers to alter certain regulations in response to tariffs without consulting the legislature for the next 2 years. And, you know, the headlines are, for example, in the CBC, it says, necessary tool or power grab. BC NDP seeks to give itself new powers to fight U.S. threats. And says, Times Call editorial, government's Bill 7 is a disgraceful overreach. This is a Times columnist. BC Greens push back on vague wording in NDP emergency powers bill. And, you know, a few other, you know, a lot of comparisons to, I think there was an article I was reading which said, this one, Rob Shaw, BC's conservative slam EB's dictatorial powers. Why do you think, I don't know how closely you follow provincial politics, but why do you think, you know, the BC NDP is doing this right now?
Yeah, it's, you know, in a moment of crisis like this one, politicians often look for kind of extraordinary measures to meet the moment. And this one seems to me potentially like a big political risk for David Eby and the NDP. The thing about a crisis like this one is there is an opportunity to really bring people together around kind of the bigger threats we face. And I think instead of trying to pass kind of an extraordinary measure that would give his government unchecked power, which comes with a lot of issues, you know, in a democracy, we really want to avoid giving our elected leaders more power than they have on paper. Yeah. And kind of avoid these kind of extraordinary situations unless they're really, really needed. I think instead David Eby and the BC NDP could be, you know, working with other parties, including the Greens, to try to come with sort of united political front against Trump rather than trying to take, you know, walk this very fine line of extraordinary powers in a crisis, which I think tends to come, it just comes with overreach. It's part of the terrain. And I'm not sure we're in an emergency that requires that level of action.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a couple of things there. It seems to me that he's, because he has a majority, but because one seat is taken by the speaker, he kind of needs the Greens to pass any legislation. And what he's actually attempting to do is have the ability to pass anything without going to the legislature for the next 2 years and just have, you know, cabinet decide everything, which seems, you know, somewhat concerning. And the other thing is that, and then maybe he'll call another election in 2 years' time. The other thing is that, you know, if you just look at it logically at the argument they're making, okay, you know, Trump has the ability to waive tariffs on and off with a magic wand. Okay, first of all, tariffs are controlled by the federal government in Canada. But if there are certain measures, for example, he gave the example of the at the ports of entry, we have trucks to Alaska, and he wanted to put a tariff on that or like some sort of cost on a duty on them as they cross through British Columbia. To carry you know, goods to Alaska. That's fine, but he could have a provision where he makes a decision in the moment, but then it needs to be ratified by the legislature within a few weeks rather than 2 years, right? And even in these interviews with the journalists, he said, oh, it will need to be ratified by the legislature. You know, everything will need to be, but that's for 2 years. It can last without being ratified by the legislature. That's a very long time. And I don't really see the need for that. Like, if Trump is doing whatever on and off switches, you can respond to him in the moment and then ratify it within, you know, the next time the legislature meets. And if the legislature doesn't want to go on with whatever emergency decision you made in the moment, then, you know, that shouldn't be the law of the land for 2 years. So yeah, it's a very, you know, odd move. And I think, I don't know what led them to thinking this was a good idea.
Well, Trump is, maybe they are, you know, if you are a leader of a province or a country and you're looking at what Trump is doing, maybe you do see, maybe you're a little bit inspired. Maybe you want a little bit more power.
Yeah, exactly.
Because this is, you know, we're watching, in the case of the United States, the norms of American democracy kind of crumble before us. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I'm someone who cares a lot about democracy. I think it's really important. I think a lot of everyday people maybe don't value democracy or see it much outside of elections, but democracy is much more than just showing up to the polls every 3 or 4 years. Democracy includes having to work with a legislature to pass legislation. You know, the idea that you could suspend that basic democratic requirement for a few years, you know, that doesn't sound like a healthy democracy. And I think we should be turning into democracy in Canada rather than turning away from democracy in Canada to respond to an increasingly authoritarian regime in the U.S. because it's really precious to be able to hold on to some of these norms. As soon as a norm is broken, you never know who the next person, you know, the next person in power, how they're going to take that norm even further.
Yeah.
So you in general want to be really careful, kind of pushing past democratic guardrails. And I think we should hold on to what we have in that sense.
Yeah, and it's a good example. If you look in the States, what is the provision that Trump is using, for example, to apply all these tariffs against Canada? He's using an Emergency Powers Act that was created some 60 years ago during the Cold War. And he's saying, okay, there's a fentanyl crisis, so now I just get to rip up all my trade agreements that were ratified by Congress and whack tariffs on everybody, right? So that's, you know, when you do these kind of things, you're creating a precedent for, you know, other peoples to do even more. This is somewhat ridiculous. Tomorrow somebody could, you know, do even more ridiculous things and say, you know, there's an emergency about fentanyl, and it is an emergency, it's problematic, and now I'm going to, I don't know, do other very unrelated policies, decisions that I just further my agenda. So yeah, I think it's hugely problematic, and I haven't heard anybody outside of the government say this is a good idea. Of course, you know, the BC Conservatives, which we haven't had time to get into today, are going through their own machinations where several members of their party they had to boot out just saying hugely inflammatory things and racist things about First Nations people and attacking their own House Speaker as basically being a traitor to their cause. Thanks so much, George, for coming on the show. Anything you want to leave us with before I wrap things up?
Well, thank you so much for having me, Armon. And, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen. If anyone listening is a U.S. citizen, we have a lot of stake in trying to resist the fall of democracy in the U.S. So just want to leave that message out there with listeners. And thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much, George, for coming on. A few other things to wrap up. You can find us at the Amarn Akil on Instagram and Twitter. So check us out there. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify. We have a new logo out, so please check that out. And we're at nine reviews. So if you could get up to 10 by next show, that would be great. The music for the show is composed with the inexorable music talents of Sarah Pratt. Every note she writes is a gift to humanity, elevating our souls to heights we never knew existed. And we do continue to have awesome guests just like George and shows lined up for you. So do continue to listen and subscribe. And yeah, hope everybody has a great evening. Good night, folks.